Times indeed were changing. Around 1967, women in the various movements, civil rights, students for a democratic society, anti-war groups, began meeting as women, and in early 1968, at a women's anti-war meeting in Washington, hundreds of women carrying torches paraded to the Arlington National Cemetery and staged the burial of traditional womanhood. At this point, and later too, there was some disagreement among women, and even more among men, on whether women should battle on specifically women's issues or just take part in general movements against racism, war, capitalism. But the idea of a feminist focus grew. In the fall of 1968, a group called Radical Women attracted national attention when they protested the selection of Miss America, which they called an image that oppresses women. They all threw bras, girdles, curlers, false eyelashes, wigs, and other things they called women's garbage into a freedom trash can. A sheep was crowned Miss America. More important, people were beginning to speak of women's liberation. Some of the New York radical women shortly afterward formed WITCH, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, and its members, dressed as witches, appeared suddenly on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. A leaflet put out by WITCH in New York said, "WITCH lives and laughs in every woman. She is the free part of each of us, beneath the shy smiles, the acquiescence to absurd male domination, the makeup or flesh-suffocating clothes our sick society demands. There is no joining witch. If you are a woman and dare to look within yourself, you are a witch. You make your own rules." Witch in Washington, D.C., protested at the United Fruit Company for the corporation's activities in the Third World and its treatment of its women office workers. In Chicago, it protested the firing of a radical feminist teacher named Marlene Dixon. Poor women, black women, expressed the universal problem of women in their own way. In 1964, Robert Coles, Children of Crisis, interviewed a black woman from the South recently moved to Boston, who spoke of the desperation of her life, the difficulty of finding happiness. "To me, having a baby inside me is the only time I'm really alive." Without talking specifically about their problems as women, many women, among the poor, did as they had always done, quietly organized neighborhood people to right injustices, to get needed services. In the mid-1960s, 10,000 black people in a community in Atlanta called Vine City joined together to help one another. They set up a thrift shop, a nursery, a medical clinic, monthly family suppers, a newspaper, a family counseling service. One of the organizers, Helen Howard, told Gerda Lerner in Black Women in White America about it. "I organized this neighborhood organization. Two men and six ladies started it. That was a hard pull. A lot of people joined in later. For about 5 months, we had meetings pretty near every night. We learned how to work with other people. A lot of people were afraid to really do anything. You were afraid to go to the city hall or ask for anything. You didn't even ask the landlord for anything. You were afraid of him. Then we had meetings, and then we weren't afraid so much anymore. The way we got this playground, we blocked off the street, wouldn't let anything come through. We wouldn't let the trolley bus come through. The whole neighborhood was in it. Took record players and danced. It went on for a week. We didn't get arrested. There was too many of us. So then the city put up this playground for the kids." A woman named Patricia Robinson wrote a pamphlet called Poor Black Woman, in which she connected the problems of women with the need for basic social change. Rebellion by poor black women, the bottom of a class hierarchy heretofore not discussed, places the question of what kind of society will the poor black woman demand and struggle for. Already she demands the right to have birth control, like middle-class black and white women. She is aware that it takes two to oppress, and that she and other poor people no longer are submitting to oppression, in this case, genocide. She allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She had been forced by historical conditions to withdraw the children from male dominance and to educate and support them herself. In this very process, male authority and exploitation are seriously weakened. Further, she realizes that the children will be used as all poor children have been used through history, as poorly paid mercenaries fighting to keep or put an elite group in power. Through these steps, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. In 1970, Dorothy Bolden, a laundry worker in Atlanta and mother of six, told why in 1968 she began organizing women doing housework into the National Domestic Workers Union. She said, "I think women should have a voice in making decisions in their community for betterment. Because this woman in the slum is scuffling hard, and she's got a very good, intelligent mind to do things, and she's been overlooked for so many years, I think she should have a voice." Women tennis players organized. A woman fought to be a jockey, won her case, became the first woman jockey. Women artists picketed the Whitney Museum, charging sex discrimination in a sculptor's show. Women journalists picketed the Gridiron Club in Washington, which excluded women. By the start of 1974, women's studies programs existed at 78 institutions, and about 2,000 courses on women were being offered at about 500 campuses. Women's magazines and newspapers began appearing, locally and nationally, and books on women's history and the movement came out in such numbers that some bookstores had special sections for them. The very jokes on television, some sympathetic, some caustic, showed how national was the effect of the movement. Certain television commercials, which women felt humiliated them, were eliminated after protest. In 1967, after lobbying by women's groups, President Johnson signed an executive order banning sex discrimination in federally connected employment, and in the years that followed, women's groups demanded that this be enforced. Over 1,000 suits were initiated by NOW, National Organization for Women, formed in 1966, against U.S. corporations charging sex discrimination. The right to abortion became a major issue. Before 1970, about 1 million abortions were done every year, of which only about 10,000 were legal. Perhaps a third of the women having illegal abortions, mostly poor people, had to be hospitalized for complications. How many thousands died as a result of these illegal abortions, no one really knows. But the illegalization of abortion clearly worked against the poor, for the rich could manage either to have their baby or to have their abortion under safe conditions. Court actions to do away with the laws against abortions were begun in over 20 states between 1968 and 1970, and public opinion grew stronger for the right of women to decide for themselves without government interference. In the book Sisterhood is Powerful, an important collection of women's writing around 1970, an article by Lucinda Sisler, Unfinished Business, Birth Control, said that abortion is a woman's right. No one can veto her decision and compel her to bear a child against her will. In the spring of 1969, a Harris poll showed that 64% of those polled thought the decision on abortion was a private matter. Finally, in early 1973, the Supreme Court decided, Roe v. Wade, Doe v. Bolden, that the state could prohibit abortions only in the last 3 months of pregnancy, that it could regulate abortion for health purposes during the second 3 months of pregnancy, and during the first 3 months, a woman and her doctor had the right to decide. There was a push for child care centers, and although women did not succeed in getting much help from government, thousands of cooperative child care centers were set up. Women also began to speak openly, for the first time, about the problem of rape. Each year, 50,000 rapes were reported, and many more were unreported. Women began taking self-defense courses. There were protests against the way police treated women, interrogated them, insulted them, when women filed rape charges. A book by Susan Brownmiller, Against Our Will, was widely read. It is a powerful, indignant history and analysis of rape, suggesting self-defense, individual or collective. Brownmiller wrote, "Fighting back. On a multiplicity of levels, that is the activity we must engage in, together, if we, women, are to redress the imbalance and rid ourselves and men of the ideology of rape. Rape can be eradicated, not merely controlled or avoided on an individual basis, but the approach must be long-range and cooperative and must have the understanding and goodwill of many men as well as women. Many women were active in trying to get a constitutional amendment, ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, passed by enough states. But it seemed clear that even if it became law, it would not be enough, that what women had accomplished had come through organization, action, protest. Even where the law was helpful, it was helpful only if backed by action. Shirley Chisholm, a black congresswoman, said, "The law cannot do it for us. We must do it for ourselves. Women in this country must become revolutionaries. We must refuse to accept the old, the traditional roles and stereotypes. We must replace the old, negative thoughts about our femininity with positive thoughts and positive action."